Hello, it's Debbie, back again with the Decatur Herald and Review e-edition on Wednesday, April 13th, 2016. Starting, of course, on its front page, there's four articles here. The first one that pops up for me is by Ryan Voiles, one of the staff writers for the Herald and Review. More options, more costs for Mount Zion Recycling, says the headline. Mount Zion. Mount Zion officials have a $100,000 question. As recycling programs continue to expand in other municipalities, village officials are left to wonder whether they should follow suit in a quest to provide more options for residents. Specifically, the option to provide residents and businesses with their own recycling carts with lids that are easy to roll out to the curb and hopefully eliminate complaints of floating debris that occur from the currently provided recycling bins. To do that, the village needs to purchase 2,000 carts, each costing roughly $50. How to pay the $100,000 price tag remains the question. It's been my dilemma to find out how to pay for that, said Village Administrator Julie Miller. The haulers don't have $100,000 to buy the carts. The village doesn't want to spend $100,000 on the carts, but we do hear from people they want to recycle. When looking at programs implemented by larger municipalities such as Decatur, Peoria, and Bloomington, Miller said it's clear the village could not take any half measures when it comes time to change its recycling plan. The most successful programs are all or nothing, she said. The programs where you get to pick and choose, you don't get the participation levels, and it's just not as successful for the community. Mount Zion was once the cornerstone of recycling in the area, being the first community in Macon County to provide bins and roadside pickup for residents and businesses. Decatur and other communities soon followed in Mount Zion's footsteps with similar programs. That changed in 2011 when changes to Decatur's garbage collection program provided residents an option of a free 65-gallon blue recycling cart along with the previously provided 18-gallon plastic bins. A lack of that option is a question that Miller and Mount Zion Board of Trustees members says has come up frequently from residents who have relocated from places such as Decatur and Bloomington that have recycling carts available to them. There was a time we were fantastic and proud of our recycling bins, just like the ones Decatur had, Miller said, but now they have the nice ones and people are used to that when they come here. The changes to other programs has put those such as Mount Zion's recycling program at a crossroad, said Board Trustee Kevin Fritchie. I think our program is at the point where we either need to decide to have a real program or not, he said. If it weren't for the cost, I don't think there'd be any reason why we wouldn't want to improve our program. The amount of recycling collected in the village points to some interest for such a program, even though village officials do not keep an official number of participants. Ron Hauser of R&M Disposal Services, one of three haulers that serve the village, said his group collects roughly 25 to 30 tons a month from Mount Zion. That's a pretty good number out of 1,500 to 1,600 customers, he said. Board officials said a revamped recycling program could also provide some cost savings for haulers as well as cost to dump recycling is $33 a ton as compared to $45 a ton to dump garbage. However, the recycling commodity market has been trending downward for months, cutting into that benefit for haulers. If the cost to dump recycling ever goes higher than that of garbage, Miller said it was likely they would terminate the program. Ideas of how to pay for the expansion remains in the discussion phase, with Miller saying they could look into partnerships with other agencies or grants to offset the cost. Other options floated around would be to increase the garbage bill or the hauler's fee. The city of Decatur charges for recycling on its water bill, an option that drew little interest from village officials. The Decatur rate of recycling for households is roughly 50%, which Miller said was a target they hoped to replicate in the village. It's not guaranteed that the village would see such an increase. For months, trustee Mike Mose said people had asked him, as former athletic director of the high school, to provide recycling options at sporting events. Recycling bins were eventually brought in during football games. The day after the game, we checked them and they were empty, Mose said. I think it's a matter of what people's habits are for recycling. We had no success at ball games. The decision is the village board's on how to proceed with any potential policy, Miller said. If it was something the board was not collectively interested in, then it's not something I need to waste my time with researching and coming up with a plan that no one wants, she said. End of the article. Next, judge rules on Sweeney lawsuit. This is by Allison Petter, another staff writer. Petty, P-E-T-T-Y, staff writer. Decatur. An attorney for former Decatur Police Chief Brad Sweeney will file an amended version of Sweeney's lawsuit against the city of Decatur following a judge dismissal of the original complaint Tuesday. Macon County Circuit Judge A.G. Weber IV heard arguments from attorneys for both sides during a hearing on the legal issues related to the case, in which Sweeney alleges his February 4th termination was retaliation by city manager Tim Gleason. Before granting the motion for dismissal, Weber made it clear the hearing was an early stage in the proceedings. If there was any idea that this was the day his case would be decided one way or another, that is not what is happening here, he said. Sweeney attended with his attorney, John D. Robinson. Gleason sat between Ed Flynn and Jerry Stocks, the attorneys representing him in the city. Attorneys for both sides declined to comment after the hearing, but Robinson told the judge he would file another complaint within 14 days, and Flynn and Stocks said they would file a response in 14 days after that. In his comments to the attorneys, Weber offered some thoughts about how they should structure their arguments going forward. He said he told Robinson he was skeptical about continuing to pursue a claim against Gleason, citing other cases in which the employer was liable before the court other than the individual. Much of the discussion during the hearing concerned an incident May 7 in which Gleason used a police vehicle and driver to make it to the St. Louis airport in time for a personal trip. Gleason had rearranged his travel plans to attend the Greater Decatur Chamber of Commerce State of the City breakfast. Sweeney had said in affidavits that he objected to the use of the police vehicle and driver at the time and later reiterated to Gleason that it was improper and would not happen again. One part of his lawsuit alleges that he was fired in retaliation for reporting the act to Gleason, a violation of the Illinois Whistleblower Act. Weber seemed to question that argument, citing another case in which the court held that someone must refuse to commit the improper action in order to receive protection as a whistleblower. Robinson conceded the Sweeney participated in Gleason's taking the police car, but only under duress. In the circumstance and situation that Chief Sweeney was in, he allowed it to happen because he didn't have any choice, he said. Weber said Sweeney did have the choice to refuse. I suppose his choice would have been to have refused and been fired on the spot, Robinson replied. Isn't that what this act is all about, then? Protection from retaliation like that, Weber said. At multiple points during the hearing, Weber reminded the attorneys the case was not being tried Tuesday. I'm hearing a lot of closing arguments from counselors on both sides that I don't see a jury in the box yet, he said. Well, there's some people who look like they could be, Judge Robinson said, apparently referring to reporters from several media outlets who were seated there. Sweeney was appointed by then-city manager Ryan McCready to serve as Decatur's police chief beginning January 3, 2015. He began his career with the department in May 1995. Gleason began his job as city manager March 23. He previously served as city administrator of Washington, Illinois. End of that article. Continuing with the courts, Snyder guilty of conspiring to kill Paige Mars. This is by Huey Freeman, a staff writer. Urbana. 1 year and 1 week after 19-year-old Paige Mars, M-A-R-S, Mars, was brutally shot to death in an isolated wooded area, the man who planned her murder was convicted by a federal jury. As the 23-year-old Decatur man sat in a swivel chair flanked by his two public defenders and guarded by two U.S. Marshals, he listened to the verdict. Quote, in the matter of the United States versus Kelton Snyder, we, the jury, find him guilty of conspiracy to kill a witness, said U.S. District Judge Colin S. Bruce, who presided over the 5-day trial. Snyder will be sentenced to life in the Federal Bureau of Prisons at a hearing scheduled for August 22nd in federal court. His sentences for convictions on charges of armed robbery and brandishing a firearm during the incident will also be held that day. He is facing up to an additional 27 years for those crimes. The jurors, 7 women and 5 men, arrived at their unanimous decision at 12:25 p.m. Tuesday. They deliberated for 4 hours, including the time they spent Tuesday morning viewing once again the surveillance video from the armed robbery that led to the death of Mars and Snyder's police interview with Decatur Detective James Atkinson on April 6, 2015, the day he was arrested. At 10 a.m. Tuesday, the jurors sent a note to the judge requesting the additional viewing sessions. In his closing argument Monday afternoon, Assistant U.S. Attorney Jason Baum said the evidence showed that Snyder was the leader of the duo that pulled off the armed robbery of the Circle K, U.S. 36 and Baltimore Avenue early the morning of April 3rd. The burden of proof to establish Snyder's guilt in the murder case was a steep hill to climb, as prosecutors admitted that Snyder's partner in the robbery, Matthew Higgins Voigt, now also 23, shot Mars to death while Snyder was at his grandmother's house. Higgins Voigt is in the Macon County Jail awaiting trial in circuit court on charges of first-degree murder and armed robbery. Baum shows the jurors an example of Snyder's leadership role Monday by screening a couple of photos captured from surveillance videos of the robbery in which Snyder is directing Higgins Voigt to fill a black bag with liquor just as they were about to exit the convenience store. In requesting to view the video itself again during deliberations, it was believed that jurors wanted to get a better view of what actually took place. In the video, it was clear that Higgins Voigt was about to leave the store behind Snyder when he was directed to grab the liquor bottles. Snyder then turned the shotgun back on the clerk and the customer who he had been holding at gunpoint. During Bohm's closing, he referred to the police interviews that occurred on Monday, April 6, the afternoon after Marr's body was found by sanitation workers near the Sangamon River, just south of the Greenwood Cemetery. The victim's identity had yet to be released to the public. First, Snyder's friend is interviewed, the one who's reported to police the previous day that Snyder committed the robbery. While he was at the police station, he received a Facebook message from Snyder, who had no idea where his friend was or that he was cooperating with the police. Snyder's message was, "You see, they found a broad's body indicator?" The friend responded, "You didn't touch it, did you?" Snyder responded, "In no way. Laughing my ass off." Oh, LMAO, no way. A short time later, Snyder was arrested and interviewed by Detective James Atkinson. The video of that interview was screened on Monday morning right before the prosecutors rested their case. In his closing, Baum referred to that interview. He screened the clip of what Atkinson told him was under arrest for robbery, and Snyder replied, "Just robbery?" But in her closing, Snyder's lawyer, Assistant U.S. Public Defender Elizabeth Pollack, said he could have been referring to other possible charges, such as weapons charges. Baum screened a second clip in which Snyder tells Atkinson that someone said he committed the robbery because people don't, blankety blank, like me. "And who would have a grudge against you?" Atkinson asked. "Maybe a dude who's here," names the friend who reported him to police. "He thinks I broke into his garage. I don't know. Some..." And then another expletive. "Who's that?" the detective said. Long pause. "Paige Mars," Snyder said. Snyder went on to say, "She said something that pissed me off, and I said, 'Stone killer over here,' and you know this conservative vice lords all day, so don't come at me with that," expletive. Snyder said during the police interview that he didn't know the last name of his friends named Matt or where he lived, although they knew each other for 6 years. The last thing the jurors did in the courtroom before completing their deliberations was to view this video of Snyder talking with Mars, pretending he did not know that his friend had just killed her. Snyder did not testify at his trial. The only witness who testified for him was his grandmother, with whom he lived about 2 days each week, indicator. He is being held in custody of U.S. Marshal's Office pending his sentence hearing. End of that. Last article for the front page. It'll sound like we've read it before, said she editorially. New meeting, no progress for state budget. This is by Dan Petrella, who's the Springfield bureau chief for the Herald and Review. Springfield. Governor Bruce Rauner and the four leaders of the Illinois General Assembly met Tuesday afternoon for the first time since November, but the gathering produced no apparent progress toward the ending of the state's months-long budget impasse. A short time after the hour-long meeting in Rauner's Capitol office wrapped up, House Democrats approved a $3.9 billion spending plan that the first-term Republican opposes. Rauner's office issued a memo Tuesday calling the measure another phony budget that promises to spend money the state simply doesn't have. It would authorize payments for higher education, social services, and other programs that have been deprived of state funding since the fiscal year began July 1st. Because the House amended a bill the Senate approved last month that now heads back for another vote, possibly as soon as today. Before the vote, House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat, Chicago, stood to defend the measure and voiced his opinion on the impasse, now in its 10th month. The typically taciturn Madigan said the state finds itself in this position because of Rauner's insistence on enacting portions of his personal political agenda and his continued refusal to compromise. Never before has the state gone this long without a budget, said Madigan, who's been speaker for all but two of the past 33 years. Every other governor that I've worked with has negotiated with the General Assembly in good faith to help the people of Illinois and to ensure that the people of our state did not needlessly suffer. The fact is, the current budget crisis was completely avoidable. While this crisis was avoidable, Governor Rauner has refused to put an end to the crisis. Madigan received a standing ovation from House Democrats before the chamber voted 65-42 to approve the bill. Among those voting against the measure was State Representative Dan Brady, Republican, Bloomington, who called it a continuation of a cruel hoax the legislature has been playing on the state's residents. "I'm not going to be part of that hoax," said Brady, who represents Illinois State University, has been part of the bipartisan negotiations on a higher education budget. Democrats didn't muster the 71 votes they'd need to override a Rauner veto. Among the Democrats who didn't vote in favor of the plan was State Representative Mike Smitty of Hillsdale. He voted present because the measure includes back pay for state workers whose raises were withheld in 2011 by then-Democratic Governor Pat Quinn. Smitty, a former Department of Corrections employee who still owed back wages, said it would have been a conflict of interest for him to vote. It was clear before Tuesday's meeting among Rauner, Madigan, Senator President John Cullerton, Democrat Chicago, and the House and Senate minority leaders, Jim Durkin of Western Springs and Christine Redagno of Lamont, that progress was unlikely. All five left the meeting without commenting. Cullerton broke the news of the meeting earlier Tuesday while speaking to a gathering of business groups at a downtown Springfield hotel. He said the meeting needed to focus on the budget, not Rauner's so-called turnaround agenda. "We've been focusing on the budget. The governor's been focusing on these other items," Cullerton said. "So I'm looking forward to today to start talking about solutions to the budget problem." Speaking to the same gathering a short time later, Rauner balked at the idea that his policy agenda is unrelated to the budget. "This is not other stuff," said the governor, who wasn't in the room for Cullerton's remarks. "Growth is the budget. Growth is the budget." Among the items on his agenda are making workers' compensation laws friendlier to employers, enacting term limits for lawmakers, and giving local governments control over what issues are subject to collective bargaining with workers. All of these changes would create more revenue for state government by attracting and retaining businesses, Rauner said. "Democrats just don't get it, or they refuse to acknowledge it," he said. He accused the General Assembly's majority party of trying to create crises in higher education, social services, and public schools to force a tax increase without enacting any of his proposed reforms. End of that article. Continuing to the local section of the front part of the A section of the paper, NAACP forum explores curbing gun violence. This is by Teresa Churchill, a senior writer for the Herald and Review. Decatur. An initial forum on reducing gun violence also covered allegations of offensive police behavior during a traffic stop. But that was okay with organizers who see improving relations between law enforcement and the community as a critical first step. Interim Police Chief James Gatt said the Decatur Police Department last year took 155 illegal guns off the street, and so far this year have seized 47. "I can tell you that's a very small percentage," he said. "We're looking for your ideas and your input so we can do better than that." Better than that. Getz was speaking Tuesday evening at Church of Jesus Christ, the Living God, at town hall meeting for senior citizens sponsored by the Decatur branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. The other sponsor was the NAACP's Area Leaders Educators Response Team, or ALERT, a group formed in collaboration with Decatur Police to encourage calm in the event of a racially charged police shooting. "Is this response team a snitch team?" "No," said Janelle Norman, president of the Decatur branch. "Its responsibility is to make sure this community gets the right information in time so we don't have our buildings burnt or our streets running wild with violence." Norman said future town hall meetings on the topic will target other age groups. In addition to Getz, other panelists were Decatur Police Detective John Jones and Macon County Sheriff's Lieutenant Tony Brown. After the panel asked about 30 people, After the panel asked about 30 people in attendance to report teenagers and other young adults hanging around abandoned houses, Barbara Owen and Jeffrey Perkins mentioned such problems in the vicinity of Johns Hill Magnet School. When Jason Cunningham, 39, spoke for 7 minutes about how a police officer stopped him, threatened him, and rudely searched his truck and his person before ticketing him for failure to use his turn signal and no front license plate, no one interrupted. Getz said he would check on the complaint Cunningham has already filed and have him come in and watch the video if the incident was recorded. "We have very good officers who do the right thing all the time, and officers who have a bad day and don't," he said. "I'll look into it and sit down with you whenever it works for you." End of that article. In education, Parsons students make superhero effort for MS Walk. This is by Valerie Wells. Decatur. "School isn't just about the 3 R's. Plenty of lessons in life happen there too. Parsons School decided on a superheroes theme for this school year, and a bulletin board in the entryway urges students to believe that superheroes are ordinary people who do extraordinary things. Being a superhero also means giving to others whenever you can. "The kids get so much," said Principal Jonathan Downing. "First Christian Church gives us so much. We want students to give to the community too." In discussing potential community projects at a staff meeting one day, the topic of multiple sclerosis, a disease that attacks the central nervous system, came up. It turns out that almost every staff member has a relative or friend with MS. First grade teacher Rhonda Ganley's sister, Brenda Farber, was the inspiration for a class project to raise money for MS research. The project is spread school-wide, and on Tuesday, the entire student body turned out for a walk for MS. Farber attended, watching from the sidelines in her wheelchair, and so did several others who had the disease. Kids gave them hugs or fist bumps as they went by, and one group stopped to pose for photos with Farber, chanting, "Walk for Brenda, walk for Brenda." Thanks to classroom donation jars and a penny jar contest for favorite superhero Wonder Woman, won by a landslide, the school raised $500. One of the things that warmed Downing's heart was that the kids learned a lesson in empathy that they won't soon forget. While the walk was dedicated to Farber as its inspiration, several classrooms made posters with the names of other people connected to staff or students who have the disease and walked in honor of them, too. "It was kind of emotional when we had staff meetings," Downey said. "We'd talk about our projects and people would talk about people and their families that have MS. That made Ganley proud, too. She told them that as her sister used a handicapped parking spot before she needed a wheelchair and that not all disabilities are obvious. Farber's gait was wobbly and she might have looked like she was intoxicated, but it was because of MS. Ganley wanted the kids to understand they should never judge on appearances alone. We took a field trip to the Children's Museum of Illinois last week, and there was a little girl there about their age in a wheelchair," Ganley said. "They were so kind to her, and they didn't bump into her, and they asked her if she needed help." End of that article. Continuing with education, school board OK's teaching assistant contract, again by Valerie Wells. Decatur. The Decatur Board of Education approved a contract with the Decatur Federation of Teaching Assistants at meeting Tuesday. The union members had voted to ratify the contract Monday. The four-year contract provides a 2% salary increase each year for current employees, and some of the contract language was updated and clarified. One of those clarifications was that teaching assistants will not have to wait to be paid for interrupted school days until the end of the year. Compensation will be on the same pay period as the interrupted day. Another clarification was that they referred to as paraprofessional educators as a result of the No Child Left Behind legislation that changed requirements for teaching assistants, though the contract language had not changed to reflect that until now. Appraisals will no longer include a review of attitude, but of professionalism. About 270 employees are covered by the contract, which includes other paraprofessionals such as licensed practical nurses, sign language interpreters, hearing and vision technicians, and braille writers for special education students, said Union President Paula Busboom. In other business, the board approved the purchase of more than 6,000 e-books to add to the district's language arts and literacy program, which is possible now that all students have electronic devices, said Ed Moyer, Chief Instructional Officer. The purchase is part of the school library upgrades implemented at the beginning of the school year and allows students access to a greater number of books than schools would have space for without the option for electronic versions. The board also approved an interorganizational agreement with Heritage Behavioral Health Center for a pilot program at Hope Academy. Board member Alida Graham questioned why Hope was chosen for the pilot. We were approached by Crossing Health Care, said Rochelle Clark, Director of Student Services. This is like the church partnerships. Hope is the nearest school, and they thought it'd be best to begin there and extend the program as needed. Heritage will have a person at Hope with an office and access to student records. Those records will be kept confidential, and Heritage will provide services to students who need them at school and home. The focus will be on social and emotional development. Kathy Massey's contract as director of Macon Piatt Special Education was approved for 4 years through 2019, and the board removed an item on a principal for MacArthur High School from the agenda. During board discussion items, Graham asked about the contract with Robertson Charter School, which was reviewed by legal counsel. Todd Kovalt, Chief Financial Officer, said that with the state's proposed change to school funding, which would fold special education funding in with general state aid, the contract as it stands would mean that the charter school would receive funding for special education, while Decatur would still have to pay for that special education. One of the provisions under negotiation is to change that provision so that Robertson could use its state aid funding to pay for special education. End of that article. Finishing section two of the April 13th Decatur Herald and Review, part one, our local briefs for today. Decatur, gas main leak. Fire crews stood by all day and into the evening Tuesday after a contractor hit a gas main and caused a leak at the corner of South Maffitt Street and East Cleveland Avenue. He said the leak presented no safety problems, but it was taking longer to shut off as utility workers tried to isolate the damage without cutting gas supplies to hundreds of surrounding customers. Decatur, free computer classes. Computer classes for low-income people will begin Monday, April 25th, at Decatur-Macon County Opportunities Corporation on Marietta Street. They'll last about 3 hours starting at 9 and meet 3 days a week for 4 weeks. Classes include keyboarding, computer basics, using the Internet and Microsoft Excel and Microsoft Word. To enroll, call 428-0155, 428-0155, starting Monday the 18th. Continuing with the shorts, Masters in Merlot. Artist Barbara Dove will conduct a class titled Masters in Merlot from 6 to 8, Thursday, April 21st at Gallery 510 on Main Street. $30, all food, wine, and materials will be provided. Can call the gallery or 422-1509, 422-1509. Decatur, underage drinking. Community talk, town hall meeting on underage drinking will be 6 to 8, Thursday, April 21st, at the Main Street Church of the Living God on Main Street in Decatur. Decatur, Elite Energy Champs. Elite Energy Show Choir won Grand Champion Saturday during the McKendree University Midwest National Show Choir Competition in Lebanon. Senior Outreach, last thing, Forsyth, the Macon County Senior Center are partnering on a senior outreach event from 1 to 3 Wednesday, April 20th at Forsyth Public Library in Elmwood. That is the end of part one, and we'll talk to you again soon.